The Castellated Home by Kenneth Frampton, which is a review. It's from Oppositions, and it's a review of Herman Mathesius's The English House, which was originally published in 1904, but translated into English in 1979. It is one of the ironies of history that many of the finer points of the English arts and crafts movement would have vanished without a trace had it not been for the painstaking documentation carried out by Herman Mathesius during his 7-year stay in England from 1896 to the end of 1903. Mathesius was not the first German to have taken an interest in British domestic architecture. In fact, one Richard Dome anticipated his concern with his own Das English Haus of 1889. However, once Mathesius's more comprehensive study was issued in 1904, it became the fundamental reference in the field and the main ideological text which informed the foundation of the Deutsche Werkbund in 1907. While frequently cited in one architectural history after another, Mathesius's magnum opus on English domesticity has only now, 75 years after its initial publication, been translated into the English language, with appropriate introductions by Dennis Sharp and Julius Posner. The sudden appearance of Mathesius in English is not without its polemical point, for clearly the Sharp/Posner circle has long since looked askance at the late neoclassical tradition in European culture. They have, one might say, maintained their distance from the taint of, quote, authoritarianism that still clings to the baseless Doric. That the English freestyle was to give way in the decade that followed Mathesius's publication to the Edwardian neoclassical reaction is remarked on by Posner in his preface, quote, "While English free architecture, or as Letherby more often calls it, building, was producing results, English critics did not very much care for it. And at the very moment somebody did care, someone from abroad, the cognoscenti, dismissed this new architecture or building, which was the architecture of Philip Webb, Norman Shaw, of Letherby himself, and of Voysey." 10 years later, Geoffrey Scott's book, The Architecture of Humanism, disposed of the remains. Country houses were built in bankers' Georgian, while Voysey, in protest, reverted to the neo-Gothic. By 1930, the international style reached England from the continent. After World War II, the, quote, new brutalism emerged. But the efforts of two generations of English architects to free building from architecture with a capital A had been almost forgotten. Mathesius's Das English Haus was originally issued as 3 separate volumes. The first dealt with the development of the English arts and crafts movement, the second treated with the social mores, that is, with the proprietal legalities and the constituent elements which determined the generic country house. Then came the third, which was fittingly given over to an account of the interior, above all, of course, to Morris's furnishing principles and to traditional arts and crafts methods for dealing with walls, ceilings, floors, fireplaces, doors and windows. The second volume is perhaps today the most fascinating to read, with its description of those programmatic appointments whose destiny it was to minister to such social activities as dining, withdrawing, reading, smoking, game playing, and last but not least, resting and bathing. As Mathesius makes clear, even the most mundane elements serve to sustain the hierarchical structure of family life. Thus, if the first volume dealt with the origins of the style, the second treated with society, that is, with the modus vivendi lying behind the style, while the third followed up with the finer points of surface treatment and equipment. In sum, the three together served to articulate the sense and sensibility of the English house. In this respect, Messrs. Letheby, Webb, and Voysey could hardly have wished for a finer chronicler of the cultural impulse in which they played their seminal roles, and indeed they were to find none, not in their own lifetime or after. Thus, the history of British culture is indebted to Mathesius in a unique way. This much is hinted at in slide collections throughout the world, which always feature arts and crafts house plans labelled in German, images which, needless to say, were taken from Das English Haus. What were Mathesius's critical reactions to the culture which he made so universally known? While discreet in public to a fault, Mathesius nonetheless seems to have perceived the subtle detours and disingenuities by which this cultural complex had come into being, together with the social and architectural consequences of its triumph. Thus we find him writing of the work of Richard Norman Shaw and Eden Nesfield in 1903. If one looks more closely into their two careers, it becomes clear that Norman Shaw moved with easy brilliance along his glittering path of progress, but Nesfield was close at his heels. If this relegates Nesfield somewhat to the background by comparison with Norman Shaw, it must be said that Nesfield was the only architect of his day who was capable of following Shaw so closely. As regards their influence on the period, Nesfield may possibly have been the more influential, at least during the 1860s. The main reason for this was probably that he had the opportunity to build on what might be called the beaten track, whereas Norman Shaw's first buildings were rather remote. In 1864, in Regent's Park in London, and in 1866, in Kew Gardens near London, Nesfield built a few small lodges that became very famous and immediately and quite specifically showed the young generation the path they would have to follow in the future. The little building in Regent's Park was an adaptation of labourers' houses in Surrey, while that at Kew Gardens was modelled on the architecture of the early 18th century with its strong Dutch influences. These little houses were found not only to be worth imitating, but they also opened the eyes of larger numbers of architects to their prototypes, many of which still existed in the country. There was now general eagerness to study them, and the fate of the so-called Italian villa in English domestic architecture was sealed. End quote. Mathesius is here referring to the Italianate villa popularised by John Nash in the 1820s. Of its subsequent typological degradation, he goes on to add, quote, "It is revealing to note that since then the term villa has become debased in linguistic usage, for until that time it had denoted something rather exalted and distinctive, roughly the meaning that it still has in Germany. Today the term is used only to describe the class of poor, jerry-built speculative housing that is provided for an ignorant public, and indeed, in everyday parlance, the term possesses comic and contemptuous overtones. The Englishman is proud to be able once more to call his dwelling place his house, which one can regard as a triumph over Italian taste and foreign influence." End quote. The density and range of this short passage is quite remarkable, and notwithstanding the subtleties of present scholarship, it is doubtful whether anyone has ever written of the English freestyle with such understanding. Unlike the many historians who have followed in his footsteps, he recognised the importance of Nesfield while still acknowledging his dependence on Shaw. Above all, Mathesius understood the extent to which Nesfield's houses were derived from the, quote, living prototypes. While we have always known that Webb worked in this way, that is to say, from the grassroots up, one has always tended to misread Nesfield, perhaps because of Shaw's urbanity, as having been detached from the true spirit of the English vernacular. Mathesius not only suggests our error in this regard, but also goes on to show the wider repercussions of this development. Last but not least, by way of surprises, one cannot help noticing certain omissions. There is no reference to, for example, Henry Hobson Richardson's Lululand, built posthumously in 1894 for the mysterious Herbert Herkomer, and little attention given to the eccentric architect and designer E.W. Godwin. One notes above all the absence of Godwin's tight street houses, built in Chelsea around 1880 for such distinguished aesthetes as Oscar Wilde and James McNeill Whistler. While such omissions could be a reflection on the slightness of Godwin's contribution, Mathesius's temperament, his evident attachment to the cult of the gentleman, is sufficient to suggest that he would have had little sympathy for the aesthete architect and his equally rarefied clients. Mathesius depended to a great extent on Robert Kerr's encyclopedic book, The Gentleman's House, first published in 1864 and reissued in 1871. Much of what he sets out in the second volume derives from Kerr, although the progressive spirit is evident from Mathesius's refusal to endorse Kerr's praise for the more perverse aspects of English country life. And yet he expressed his reservations with great delicacy when he wrote, quote, "The book has, however, lost some of its value since it does not include certain recent ideas, especially those concerning sanitation and others that have similarly changed." Nonetheless, Mathesius covered the same ground, expatiating with relish upon the eccentricities of English upper middle class life. Quote, "The commonest form of entertaining among the middle classes is the, quote, at home, which takes place either at 9 in the evening or in the afternoon when it is attended mainly by women. Refreshments are of the simplest, even the most primitive kind. Indeed, a German would pronounce them positively inadequate. They consist of coffee, tea, fruit cup, cakes, and sandwiches. But one has the feeling that no one would come on account of the food or attach any importance to it. The nursery in the English house is always run and served quite separately. Except when they are driven out or taken for a walk, the children spend the whole time in the nursery under the supervision of women engaged for the purpose, and contact with their parents is far less frequent than in continental households. But extreme punctiliousness and constant supervision and guidance ensure that a generation will rise that will be sound in body and mind, and whose strengths will lie in stability, toughness, and steadfastness of character." End quote. At times, Mathesius's critical Anglophilia is tempered by disapproval bordering on disdain, as, for example, in the mild sardonic tone assumed when writing of the provisions made with regard to door swings. Quote, "The rule known to every Englishman says that the door must open toward the main sitting area in the room, which usually means toward the fireplace. In a study, it opens toward the desk, in a bedroom, toward the bed. The idea behind this is that the person entering shall not be able to take in the whole room at a glance as he opens the first crack of the door, but must walk around it to enter the room, by which time the person seated in the room will have been able to prepare himself suitable for this entry." And yet he was to approve unequivocally of the English practice of isolating the water closet. Quote, "But we must stress the fact that in England a lavatory is never actually in the bathroom. 50 years ago it may still have been permissible to put both in the one room, but today it would be considered barbarous and is, we repeat, totally inadmissible. It is to be hoped that we in Germany will also soon begin to question the rightness of the custom. Even if it in it even in its most splendid form, a lavatory is an appliance that one would prefer to keep out of sight as far as possible, primarily for aesthetic reasons. It is therefore also entirely out of place in the bathroom. Even there, its presence evokes unpleasant associations of ideas, even assuming that the closet is entirely odorless, which can never be taken for granted. All in all, the small part played, that was a quote. All in all, the small part played by bathing in English upper middle class life, explained away by Mathesius as an aspect of English Puritanism, is testified to in a surprising way by many of Shaw's townhouses, where a 5-floor, 6-bedroom townhouse with 2 water closets and only 1 bathroom is the rule rather than the exception. So that refers to the terrace houses by Norman Shaw at 68 Cadogan Square, London, of 1885. Despite this evident reluctance to bathe more than once a week, it is nonetheless clear that the Arts and Crafts House reflected the domestication of the English male, above all with regard to the rights of dining, drinking, and smoking. Thus Mathesius writes, quote, "It used to be that the custom in England to remove the tablecloth from the gleaming polished mahogany table, even before the dessert and after the meal, the men embarked on a drinking bout that, as in the 18th century, not infrequently ended in the whole company being drunk. The English gentleman of today no longer drinks, and he smokes only very moderately. So there is no longer any reason for him to ensconce himself at the dinner table for considerably longer than the women, whom, as we have said, he follows into the drawing room after a speedily smoked cigar, and with whom he converses without smoking or drinking. He has, in fact, entirely departed from his former ways and has become, quote, fit for the drawing room." Of the contradictions which have been necessary in order to present the English house in one volume, the original volume dealing with the interior has been the most drastically curtailed, for previously it treated at length with the evolution of the British interior, including the Neo-Palladianism of Adam, Sheraton, Chippendale, and Hepplewhite. In the shortened version, most of the space goes to the freestyle reformers, to Burgess, to Godwin, and above all to Morris, for the extravagant pre-Raphaelite interior that he designed in 1891 with Letherby for Stanmore Hall. Thus, English House also includes a number of extraordinary interiors and plan forms which have somehow come to be repressed in the received accounts of the period. Above all, of course, houses by M. H. Bailey Scott, whose posthumous reputation has been growing ever since the 1972 monograph written by James D. Cornwolfe. As Cornwolfe was to remind us, Bailey Scott's masterwork, Blackwell, built at Bowness in Westmoreland in 1899, is to be classed among the proto-modernist spatial compositions of the period. It is clear that from Mathesius's treatment that the central hall of Blackwell, with its Tudor gallery, inglenook and mezzanine, smoking loft, was spatially unusual. And, as Cornwolfe implies, it may be seen as anticipating the galleried triple-height entry hall of Le Corbusier's Maison La Roche of 1923. If modernist layered space is latent in Blackwell, then it is equally present as vertical displacement in Voysey's Norney Grange, Godalming of 1897. And above all, in the central hall of George Walton's The Lays, built at Elstree, London, in 1901. Apart from Mathesius in 1904 and Pevsner in 1939, Walton remains the unsung other architect of the Glasgow School, not only for the Leys, L-E-Y-S, but also for his textiles and his work for Kodak in London and Brussels. Like E.S. Pryor's The Barn Exmouth of 1897, a work which exercised an influence on Mathesius's Freudenberg House of 1907, Walton's double-height central hall within the rather blocky massing of the Leys is patently proto-modernist. From the McMurdo-like screen to the main stair and gallery, which jointly serve to articulate the triple height volume of the hall, to the ingenious spiral stair connecting the maid's bedroom to the scullery, Walton is already engaged in spatial strategies which we will later recognise as modern. It is significant in this context that both the barn and the Leys are relatively small and compact houses, a butterfly plan in one instance and a U-plan in the other, the barn having 6 bedrooms and the Leys mustering no more than 5. These works surely presaged the end of the rambling English country house. Turning the pages of the English house, reading the measured observations of Mathesius's meticulous text, one cannot help being struck by the fact that this was the last occasion, at least in English history, when there was a close correspondence between the aspirational ethos of the architectural professional and the traditional yet evolving mores of that society. It would seem that by the turn of the century, a wide range of social classes were beginning to be housed according to the ethos and precepts embodied in Mathesius's compendium, from W. H. Bidlake's Lutyensian extravaganzas built for nouveau riche businessmen to Ralph Heaton's cottages erected for Cadbury's workmen at Bourneville. From the grandiose Scottish Tudor settings achieved by Sidney Mitchell and Wilson to the freestyle 6-story walk-up flats built in web-like brick syntax by the LCC in Plimlico and Bethnal Green. It is sobering to reflect how World War I destroyed this egalitarian culture. The depredations of the war not only eliminated a generation, but also disrupted the stability of an economy which was beginning on the eve of the hostilities to build well for a wide strata of society. Admittedly, Scott's reactionary texts published at the outbreak of war already moved to undermine the movement, as did the fact that the Midland and Northern slums were to remain as, quote, great national wens for another 50 years. But this state of affairs was certainly not improved by the loss of confidence that succeeded the war and by the confused planning policies which led to nothing more elevating in the interwar years than the introduction of the bypass as the forerunner of the modern freeway and the endless proliferation of vulgarised stockbrokers' Tudor. The 3-up and 2-down semi-detached petty bourgeois builder's villa, which became the pre-depression instrument for the degradation of the arts and crafts. These endless strip suburbs are surely among the more depressing developments that the 20th century has produced. It is sobering to realise that the, quote, cultured environments of Bedford Park and Bourneville could not be repeated without detrimental results, except in the seemingly endless pine stands that skirt the western periphery of Berlin, where, thanks to Mathesius, the poetic of the freestyle suburb was to attain its more elegant and lyrical expression. Well, I guess this is me now. I guess that if you're really into the history of the plan, especially like through Western civilization or at least the 20th century, Yeah, you won't be. I guess I wasn't surprised that he'd lifted a lot from the gentleman's house, but I was pretty excited that the, because I've never seen the full three volumes, so I'm definitely going to try and get my hands on the third, which goes more into the interior. As for Frampton's review, I think maybe it's a little bit neither here nor there, except it is important to note that the arts and crafts might not be so well documented without Mathesius, as well as the fact that it influenced people like, well, obviously the formation of the Werkbund and people like Loos, which is probably well, it's not mentioned here and can't be understated enough, I think. And then probably also, you know, everyone who worked for Loos or was trained by Loos, like Greta Schutte-Lachotsky and maybe even Frank, who knows. And then as for the take, his take about the layered space coming from the arts and crafts, we've, Andrew and I have just gotten into Cornwolf's book on Bailey Scott, and that is totally all from Cornwolf, so that's not that's not Frampton's either. Maybe worth looking a little bit closer at some of these other architects, as he calls them, like Walton.